Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. I'm up here in Washington, D.C., where Keith Nix has come to join us. He's got some meetings here in Washington, D.C. He's from Richmond. He is the head of the Veritas School in Richmond, Virginia. Been there 8 years,
yeah.
Keith, right now. And he's also the vice chairman of the Association of Classical and Christian Schools and president of the Board of Academic Advisors for the Classic Learning Initiatives. Those are the people who do the CLT test that we had a few episodes ago. Anyway, welcome, Keith.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, so you're running a school. It's a religious school, private school in Richmond, Virginia. And, of course, you're having a tough time. Enrollments are down. The culture all around you is insisting that you become more secular, and you're having to do that because if you don't, people are going to leave. Is this correct?
The best thing I can say is that's about the furthest thing from the truth. We have Veritas started in 2000. I've been there since 2010 when we had an enrollment of around 200 students. In the last 8 years, we've grown to 585 students from 200.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I think that's, let's see, what is that? What is that? What did you say? Growth about 15%
a year? 12 to 15% a year, yeah, for the last 7 or 8 years.
This is amazing. And when we hear about enrollments going down in a lot of Catholic schools and a lot of church going down, this is quite a stunning reversal in those numbers. Why do you think this is happening?
Well, I think originally Christian families that cared about academics, for lack of a better word, hopefully a better way to say it would be the life of the mind or the intellect, Christian scholarship. But to be honest, in the early days, Christian families that wanted a authentic Christian environment that didn't compromise on scholarship. So the early message was discipleship, you know, a place where our children are catechized or Christian formation is a priority. It's not just a public school curriculum with a little bit of Bible or a memory verse, but it really, the school viewed partnering with families in this formation of young Christian men and women. Mm-hmm. And not just so your kid could get into a great college or score, you know, get a good score of the SAT. That's what some people were looking for, but what we've had to grow in our school and with our families, which has worked well, is, yeah, we want to do academics well, but because the life of the mind matters in terms of stewardship. You know, we're to love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. And so we can't just give Jesus our hearts. We've got to give him our heads. And so what does it mean to do academics well for the glory of God, not for the SAT score? And so that's been part of the message. And it's worked, for lack of a better word, meaning our school has demonstrated really fine results academically. But more importantly, families have found us to be a partner that really is aligned with them.
Mm-hmm.
We talk
mm-hmm.
about shared and agreed upon goals.
Well, this is one thing that I think we at religious schools, my son's in a religious school now, a classical Christian school, one of the things that we've had to contend with is, well, you know, you could in one way you could call it a 100-year-long argument from the secular progressives, or maybe a 500-year-old argument about it, mm-hmm. that draws a line between science and religion, and that says the stronger you are in your religious formation, the weaker you will be in all your secular areas of study, is particularly, you know, in the scientific fields, and that we really have a challenge to say no. And I think what you just said about your kids going on, they're leaving you are K through 12,
right?
They graduate, they go to the top schools. Many of them that go to selective schools, you actually have admissions officers. You told me, but before, you've got admissions officers who are seeking out your students for applications, and that the Christ-centered orientation, your argument would be, this actually enhances their performance in the secular subjects. Is that something that you say actually, or that you argue to parents?
We do. We
who are the sort of the achievement track?
Yeah,
they want the achievement here. The test scores, the college admissions.
So the way we answer that question is we spend a lot of time telling parents, yeah, those results will come, but that's not what we're aiming for. It's too short of a goal, too small of a goal. Mm-hmm. We have the long view in mind. Mm-hmm. We're talking about what kind of human beings and adults they are when they're 30, 40, and 50, mm-hmm. what kind of old men and women they're going to be. Mm-hmm. And so let's build a school that cultivates wisdom and virtue, that cultivates affections, loves for things that are true and beautiful and good. Mm-hmm. These things will last. Mm-hmm. Memorizing something that gets you a high test score and gets you into college ends pretty quickly. But guess what? If we attend to the things that we're talking about attending to, guess what we're seeing? High test scores.
I would add to this that, you know, I'm teaching in the university. I've been teaching in the university since the 1980s. And one does see the phenomenon that a lot of people have talked about is the burnout factor from mm-hmm. the high achievement kids. They're the ones who took all the AP courses. There was a book about a dozen years ago called The Overachievers by a journalist who went into a high school, actually in Montgomery County, Maryland, and profiled these real super ambitious kids who were looking at Ivy League. They were taking four or five AP courses per semester. And part of the profile was, boy, are these kids, I mean, spiritually, they're dying emotionally. They're overwhelmed, and she anticipated we're going to see problems in the next few years, and you do see that at where I teach, and it's a national trend. You've heard about the higher rates of depression and anxiety that afflict kids, and often the high performer kids, and I would say that one reason is because they didn't get the spiritual formation, they don't have their grounding in the Sermon on the Mount,
mm-hmm.
and that's something that can prevent that overachieving craziness from taking over.
Yeah, and the academic achievement that they're after isn't in the right context. It's the idol. It's the god. It's the whether it's theirs or their parents.
That's a good way of putting it.
The bumper sticker on the back of the car that shows. How smart my kids are and how much they achieve. But so academic pursuits, caring about scholarship, but in the context of worship and stewardship and my place in the world, what does God want for me and from me? So we have to be careful that we don't feed that race to nowhere mentality. In the classical school movement, the word skole or restful learning is something we think and talk about. We have longer lunch periods. We have longer passing periods.
Interesting.
We don't try to cram in. One of the classical themes is or ideas is much, not many, right? Multum, not multus. I'm not a Latinist, so I'll probably pronounce that wrong. But the idea is, even at a great book school, we can't read the temptation. No. We're not trying to read every great book. It'd be better to read one well, to do one thing well. And so we've got to realize in classical Christian education, the barnacles that we still have on us, you know, that grew up through modern progressive education, we're recognizing and shaking things off. Every year we do this kind of work, we're getting better at it.
So you really see yourselves as sort of coming out of a, you know, a 70-year steady secularism, progressivism, primary and secondary education universe, and it's taken time.
It's taken time.
To build this new, but it's growing like crazy.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, a lot of us 10, 15, 20 years ago saw the benefit. We recognized, yeah, this kind of a liberal arts classical education that taught logic, that taught rhetoric, that ensured our kids were their writing and their oral communication ability was strong. That all made sense because we lacked it. We recognized the lack. My buddies and I standing around church in Birmingham, Alabama, talking about the football game. Where was the conversation that was deeper, more meaningful? Because we'd read some, we weren't talking about reading Homer together, right?
Right.
Or Augustine.
And I think that's a key. You're reading it together.
Yeah.
We can talk about it. The kids, they've all gone through this together, and it gives them a classical Christian basis for relating to one another. You mentioned you go back to the old grammar, logic, rhetoric. I'll tell you where things are in the public school. I was part of a group crafting national standards in English language arts several years ago. And the leaders of the group who convened everyone, they say, okay, we need a logic strand where we teach logic. And there were a few people in the room who were arguing, just as long as we understand that every logical argument always takes place within a political and ideological context, and that we need to get this understanding in there. And to me, this was a faulty approach that is part of the everything is political orientation. And so you really don't – what's going to happen in a classroom of that kind is you're really not going to be teaching logic. You're going to be teaching political activities that go under the guise of logic. And I actually intervened in that discussion and said, that's not logic. Okay, that's something else. You can do that,
right,
but that's separate from logic. And when the ancient Greeks developed logic, for them it was a liberation from political circumstances. Wait, we can evaluate principles and axioms, beliefs and propositions. We can evaluate them outside of the worldly situation. Everything isn't situational. They said we can do this, and they found that a liberation. That was an advance of the mind. And our students who can't treat an argument independently of politics, just logically, are the premises and conclusions related to one another valid? Do they have validity or not? We don't even suspend the truth issue. But to me, that right there was one of the terrible forms of deterioration that you're bringing back.
Yeah, and it's absent from most schools' curricula nationally. The teaching of logic, similar to the way Latin was treated over the last 100 years, they're dismissed. And it's not because it's a dead Latin was a dead language. It was the language of the church is why it was dismissed from our schools. And so we've lost something. So what we're trying to do, we recognize our own lack. People like me that got involved in starting and growing schools, we realize our students need logic. Our students need these rhetoric skills to be able to live in this world. They need the ancient languages.
When do you start them on Latin?
Most classical Christian schools begin a Latin program in the mid grammar school, third grade, fourth grade. So we do. One of the challenges is as our school's grown, we have so many students coming in sixth, seventh, and eighth. We do some Latin that's preparatory, but we don't penalize the student who's coming in seventh grade, because we want that student to become literate, and fluent in Latin as well. So we require three levels of Latin for all of our students. It ends up being 4 years, seventh grade through 10th grade.
Everyone has to do at least 4 years of Latin.
Yeah.
Or at least show.
They can
come in 11th grade if they have some Latin.
That's
already,
right. If students, we don't accept very many students coming in
right, that
10th
late.
Or 11th. If we do, it's probably some unique circumstance. And so we make some accommodations. But for the most part, we have three different diplomas, a classical studies diploma, an advanced classical studies diploma. But we also have, for those students who couldn't get the full benefit of all the logic, all the rhetoric, all the Latin, a college prep diploma, which is our lowest. You understand it's our minimal. The college prep diploma is our low one. Does that make sense?
Right. That makes good sense. What do your students read in English in 11th, 12th grade? Give me some of the sample books that they read.
So they'll read Augustine, the Confessions, the Consolation of Philosophy, Boethius, the Rule of St. Benedict, The Beowulf, The Song of Roland, The Divine Comedy, would be some Paradise Lost. If I've got
really,
yeah, we've adjusted our scope and sequence, but that's the kind of quality of work they're reading.
This is fantastic. And here's on the achievement factor. What a lot of people don't know who argue for more, quote, cultural relevance in the classroom, where we need more contemporary literature, we need more multicultural literature instead of just this Eurocentric tradition. What they don't take into account is what happens when these kids go to college, because they're going to go to college and they have to take courses that involve history. I mean, they have to fulfill their general ed requirements. Even if they're going to be engineers, they're going to have to take an English class, a freshman writing class, a history class of some kind. And if they've read the things that you are having them read, they have a huge advantage over the students in those classes who don't. If you have to read Abraham Lincoln's speeches and you've never done anything with the Bible in school, you're at a disadvantage from those kids who have. I mean, the Bible is all over Lincoln's writings. They're everywhere. You know, if you take American literature, Paradise Lost is all over Melville, for instance.
That's right.
So you're giving what sometimes goes by the name of cultural literacy. Just on secular terms, this is a huge benefit for, in their terms, a huge benefit for the kids in at the next level.
So. Yeah, I totally agree, and that's what our students who have graduated and gone off to college, that's what they've reported back to us among their peers.
On the Latin score, I've had students say, because in when I teach, I'm always, when we're going over literature, a poem, and always pulling out a word that I'll say, what is the etymology of that word? And no one's ever asked them for the etymologies of things. So I'll give them sheets of Latin and Greek prefixes and then main roots of words. And they all say, if I knew this, if I got this in 10th and 11th grade, my SAT verbal score would have gone up 100 points. And I said, you're right. It would have.
Exactly, yeah.
So
you're hitting on some very practical benefits that we do advocate, and we do help parents understand that a basis in Latin helps you in these ways. But what's even more beautiful, because even if you teach Augustine or read the Confessions and do it poorly, it's still better than not doing it.
It's an exposure, right? But, it's just basic familiarity.
But the beauty happens when you have a teacher that helps them love Augustine.
Right.
Doesn't just assign the book, but that's where the phrase we like to use at Veritas is, if we're asked what curriculum do we use, well, the teacher is the curriculum. So I partly agree with St. John's when they list their great books and the authors and say, welcome returning faculty, and have Augustine and Aquinas listed. I do partly agree with that, but that's different if you have a teacher who loves Augustine, as Augustine is learning to love God, and then infects students so that you don't just read the great books, but if their affections are cultivated by infectious teachers, they learn to love the great books, even if they don't like a particular book, or if they don't particularly like, you know, say in math, we use Singapore math. We want teachers to help students more than anything have a love and appreciation for math. It's a game changer.
Right.
But when you understand that math came from God, if we believe that math is from God and not from man.
This is the music of the spheres.
It's the music of the spheres.
This is celestial.
So if you take it and make it utilitarian, then you tell students you can take it or leave it versus this is something that God has for you. So this teacher, that's where the teacher's the curriculum. Singapore might be a great math curriculum, but only to the extent that the teacher can help the students begin to see something transcendent and lovely in the math, then you're on to something.
Now,
and the second part I would say about curriculum, you got to have good content. There's bad curriculum. You got to avoid bad curriculum. But choosing good curriculum will not build your school.
Yeah.
But building a faculty that can lead the students is part of it. And the second is when you're teaching that curriculum, the ideals that you're going after are not just utilitarian. They're you're going after truth, beauty, goodness, wisdom, virtue, freedom, justice, mm-hmm. immortality. Mm-hmm. So that's our curriculum. Mm-hmm. Those ideals with teachers that take that great content and do something with it. That's what our schools have to have.
Now I see a problem, Keith, and that is if you've got an education system that is overwhelmingly contemporary and progressivist and flattened in humanities, at least in that way, and in the sciences is all utilitarian, these young people, teachers whom you want to hire, do you have a big enough pipeline of teachers who can come in and do this kind of curriculum, or they just haven't been formed in it?
We don't have a big enough pipeline. It is improving. Yeah. There are some universities, some honors colleges that are starting programs specifically to develop teachers for classical Christian schools. So we're I'm excited about that. We also have a generation now of students who received a classical education, mm-hmm. even though it was the early stages of the renewal of the movement. Mm-hmm. Still, they've been a part of those principles, and they've experienced at least to some extent what that looks like. What they'll be able to do in the next generation is so much better than they were able to receive, because we were finding teachers who were willing to teach Latin, mm-hmm. who had to learn it first or just ahead of the students. But now we have a pool of Latin teachers. But the pipeline's not big enough. It's one of our challenges.
You have to go out and really actively recruit.
Actively
especially
recruit.
With the growth that you've had.
Yep. Actively recruit, train,
yeah.
untrain, retrain.
Right.
Because our system isn't set up to train teachers to do what we were just talking about.
Do you require the teachers to be certified, state certified?
Absolutely not.
You know, a lot of Catholic schools actually want their teachers state certified, and I think they feel that this gives parents more confidence in what they're doing.
I'm fearful for the compromises that Christian schools make, but out of fear, like, be good at what you do, and you will attain the credibility you need. We don't do people. A lot of people resistantly do AP courses for that reason. We don't. We don't do AP courses.
You have no AP?
None.
All your courses are AP.
They're all AP. They're better than the AP
They're
courses.
They're better than AP. That's
yeah, I don't
right.
want to be
That's
constrained
right.
or confined by them. Now, some classical schools do offer them, and they have found a way to not compromise on their curricular goals and objectives and still offer AP. So I'm not poo-pooing on that idea completely.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'd rather not do it if we can not do it and help colleges and universities see our students for who they are and what they can do, and that's been happening.
And this is where your growth can come into play in polemical terms. For when people say to you, look, if you don't have AP, then you're not going to, you know, parents aren't going to want to bring your students. You turn around and say, we can't keep up with the demand.
Right.
Well, but wait a minute, if you're asking all of this Latin, a lot of students, they don't want to take Latin. They're not going to come. We can't keep up with the demand, okay? They're coming. You know, nothing beats success, right? We have the numbers here. They are – we're in demand. That growth, you can't handle that growth.
We're done. We're almost 600 students now, 585.
Yeah.
Our target max goal is 650, and it's just
the lower grades larger than the upper grades?
They're all the same, K through 8, about 50 students per grade, mm-hmm. and 9 through 12, they're in their 30s. But
okay,
in four years, those
right.
So we just graduated our last single section. So our first 8 graduating classes were all in the teens or
mm-hmm.
single digits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This current senior class is our first class that we ever – it was the first one we doubled, I mean, you know, years ago. I think when I arrived at the school, they had just started doubling, you know, kindergarten first and second. So that's come through the pipeline in the last 8 years.
So
and now triple per class, so 3 sections.
What this means is you're – selectivity is being forced upon you more and more.
Yep.
Do you see any, do you worry, I mean, this is a luxury to have this worry,
yeah.
but do you worry that you're just going to start, you know, drifting more toward that high achiever, you know, super ambitious type, and then you might see some of the sort of the spiritual aspects diminish in the school. Is that a worry?
So
maybe not.
It's not. I mean, it's a valid worry. Why I'm personally not worried about it is because of the guardrails that we have in place and our commitment to socioeconomic diversity. But philosophically, the way we position ourselves is we are a school for families. So some family that's just trying to enroll one student, you know, for, you know, in high school for academic reasons, but the rest of their kids are going to another school or the public school.
No.
That's not what we do. We're a school for families, which means the academic aptitude is going to be across the board. Yeah, you're a family with three or four kids. You're probably going to have one that needs, you know, have a learning issue. And so we have a robust learning support program for kids years ago that wouldn't have been able to stay at our school, but now they are, because we don't want families divided. We want to keep whole families together. It's part of our philosophy. So we're really looking for missionally aligned families in admissions. We're not looking for a particular set of academic standards.
Right.
So, secondly, we have a huge commitment to socioeconomic diversity. So our tuition assistance numbers quite large. And we've got ratios in place that I'm bound by. It's a healthy binding to make sure that we're I've got a number of things in place that make sure we enroll, including our statement of faith, that we enroll. The primary thing we're looking for is families with shared and agreed upon goals and values.
So here's the ideal outcome for that family with the high achiever kid and say, hey, they're pretty good. They're placing students. We'll get our son there in 10th grade, but they're not really devoted people. They may be registered in a parish, say, or something. But you get that student in your school, into the curriculum, and that student goes back home with a spiritual formation and brings it back to the family. And actually, that's upbringing. I mean, I don't. That probably hasn't happened, but
yeah,
because you've already got committed families.
But I can see the students
going back into the family and reinforcing the devotion, reinforcing the faith.
Oh, I think that happens even across the spectrum from our families, that even our families that you would mark as a real spiritual depth of maturity, but because of the busyness of life and the desires of the flesh, the temptations. I mean, having your children come home who've just gathered after lunch every day. Our high school students gather after a long lunch because we think the table's important and how you handle meal times are important. So that's a part of our liturgy and our life. But after lunch, they come together and sing the doxology out loud on the quad before they go back to class. We start the day with prayer and hymn singing. And so we have these liturgies, these practices, and parents tell us all the time, we're equipping a generation to know all the great hymns, to keep those alive. And a lot of parents are disappointed because their church isn't doing that as much.
Interesting.
Or the catechesis, the catechisms that their kids are learning and coming home and talking about at the table. So from our least mature families, spiritually speaking, are the ones that aren't in churches that are probably doing them the best service in terms of instruction and teaching, to the ones that are like my family was so appreciative. My wife and I are so grateful that we had that support, that our kids were interacting in a community of faith and learning that was invigorating our dinner table discussions. I think they bring it home, and families are thankful for what they see their kids bringing home.
Good. I think that's a nice moment to conclude. So we'd love to hear about Veritas School in 2 years, Keith. But thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Okay. Pleasure to be here.